Shalom. Welcome back. This is Jeffrey Sachs of Web Yeshiva and Mishkan Sipora of Efrat. And we are on Daf Yud Dalet Omud Aleph, 14a in Masechet Ta'anit, in the middle. We're talking about Ta'aniot. We're not talking about Ta'aniot like Shivoser Batamuz, which is coming up in a couple of weeks. We're talking about the Ta'aniot that would be instituted in cycles of three fasts, Monday, Thursday, Monday, a subsequent cycle of three fasts, Monday, Thursday, Monday, and then, God forbid, if we haven't been answered, a cycle of seven fasts, Monday, Thursday, Monday, Thursday, etc. These would be instituted by Batei Din in various places, particularly in cases of drought or other calamity. The Gemara brings a braita. The Gemara actually brings three braitiot. Tani chada. One braisa says, Uberet umeineket mitanot barishonot ve'ein mitanot ba'achronot. Pregnant and nursing women fast on the first cycle of fasts, but do not fast on the second cycle of fasts. Vetanya idach, and there's another braita, obviously one which seems to disagree. Mitanot ba'achronot, ve'ein mitanot barishonot. Pregnant nursing women fast on the second cycle of fasts, but are exempt from fasting on the first. Vetanya idach, and a third braita says, ein mitanot lo barishonot, ve'lo ba'achronot. They fast neither on the first cycle nor on the last cycle. So now here we have three apparently contradictory braitiot. You've all been learning Gemara for a little while. What's the Gemara's first kind of knee-jerk reaction when presented with evidence such as this? What's the impulse, what's the Talmudic impulse when we put these three cards on the table?
Different cases?
Oh, well, I mean, and what's the impulse there? What would it be trying to accomplish by doing that?
To avoid machloket.
Oh, the Gemara does not like... It's a kind of funny thing, because people think, what's the Gemara? The Gemara, what's Talmudic? What's a Talmudic discussion? A Talmudic discussion is, you know, people, I go like this, and you go like that, right? A debate, an argument, discussing important matters from different points of view and coming to different results. But in fact, that stereotype of the Talmudic debate really overlooks the fact that the first impulse of the Talmudic mind is to resolve machloket, is to try to show that there is in fact no machloket, particularly in a matter such as this, which has a real nafka mina lehalocha. Now, plenty of times that impulse cannot be satisfied. The Gemara will not be able to resolve a stira, and we'll have to say there are two different traditions. But the normative halacha is like the following. At the end of the day, we need to know what to do. We need to know when to fast. We need to know, is this food kosher or not kosher? Is this utensil tameh or tahor? And if we're unable to resolve the machloket, at least in the end, we have to arrive at a bottom line normative halacha. But before we do that, we'd like to first show, the first impulse is to show there really is no machloket. The apparent machloket is the product of our misunderstanding. And there are different ways to do this. One way, as David points out, is to show what I like to call apples and oranges. It appears that these two sources are in conflict. In fact, they are discussing two separate independent cases, and therefore they are not in conflict. What might be another way to resolve this?
You have to basically resolve it. In other words, leave it to say that they're three different opinions. After all, there's plenty of places...
Yes, no, but Yehudi, yeah, correct, but that's always the last resort. In other words, to admit that there are braitiot in conflict with each other, and nevertheless we have to find one operative halakha. That's the last resort. But if we want to show that in fact there is no machloket, how can we go about doing that? So the case that the strategy that David suggested, apples and oranges, to show we're talking about two different cases. Hocha b'maya skinan. What are we talking about in this case, and what are we talking about in that case to show that these are different things? Another way the Gemara sometimes approaches this is to show that there are three traditions here, but in fact, let's take a simpler case. Let's say we only had two braitiot in conflict. To show that one of the braitiot is in fact a corrupted tradition, that is not what the Tana really said or really meant or really held, and therefore there's no contradiction because we have to dismiss one of the sources as authentic, leaving the other one standing on its own two feet with no objection, with no contradiction. And there are different strategies that we've seen over the course of our time studying together. But here we have three sources in conflict about which of the, I'll say this in with an asterisk around it, which of the two cycles of fasts does a pregnant and nursing woman have to fast on? Does she fast on the first but not the second? On the second, but not the first, or on neither? Those are the three options. If this were a classroom and I had a blackboard, and I do have a virtual blackboard, but I'm not going to use it right now. If I had a blackboard, I would put these three, A, B, and C, these three cases on the board. So, Omar Rav Ashi, Nakot emtsoita biyadcho, dimitartsun kulhu. Rav Ashi says, take the middle position, as the kind of definitive, because it resolves all three braitiot. Which middle do you take in your hand? Well, we were talking about the first or the second or the first, or neither of the two. But Rav Ashi reminds us, in fact, there are three cycles of fasts. The first three, the middle three, and the final seven. So Rav Ashi says, the middle fasts, the women should fast only on the middle fasts. And that can be, you know what, let me do that. Let me open up a whiteboard. Now they switch this every few weeks. They change all of the controls. And they move everything around. And I can't find how to open the whiteboard. Hold on a second. Oh, okay, here we go. Right? That's no good. A. No, also that's no good because it's the wrong color. A, B, and C. A says first, not last. B says last, not first. And C says neither. But in fact, Rav Ashi reminds us, there are three sets of fasts. He went to Mariv. The first set is three fasts. The second set is an additional three fasts. And the third set is seven fasts. So Rav Ashi says, we're talking about the middle fast. The first braita which says she should fast the first, not the last, is talking about which first and which last. In other words, we have three things, and we're trying to figure out which of them is the first and which of them is the last. Really, we should be talking about first, middle, and last. So what's the first and the last according to Brighton A? Is the second and the third fast. So when we say she fasts the first but not the last, really we're saying she's fasting the second cycle. And
how can you actually say that that's, in other words, on what basis are you saying that?
The Gemara is saying, Rav Ashi is saying, this is the way to properly read these Braytiot. In other words, the Braytiot are all, let's say, imprecise, which might be a reason that they were not included in the Mishnah. But you have these three traditions, which perhaps in their time were understood, but because they're so imprecise and so unclear, they were relegated to the Braytiot. But nevertheless, Rav Ashi wants to understand how to resolve the three of them. So he's presenting a way to read all three Braytiot, which appear on the face of them to be talking about a three-way machloket, to show that if you hold them up to the light in a certain way, you can align them that they are in fact not in contradiction with each other. So let's first, before we say how could he say this, let's first figure out what he's saying. So the way to read all three Braytiot so that there's no machloket, we say that a pregnant woman, only fasts on the middle fasts. So in the first Brayta A, when it says she fasts the first but not the last, the first refers to cycle 2, and the last refers to cycle 3. So she's only fasting here. When the second Brayta says she fasts the last fasts, it means this is the last fast. We ignore this. We look at this and this. Right? In other words, we have three items, but the Braytiot are only referring to two. So obviously, each of the Braytiot is ignoring one of the three possibilities. Brayta A that says first, not last, right, is trying to figure out which of these two she's fasting. And Brayta A says she fasts here, but not here. Brayta B, which is only exploring two of the three possibilities, is only exploring these two. And it says she fasts the second round, but not the first. So you see, you can read these confusing Braytiot in a way in which they are not in contradiction. And the third Brayta, which says she fasts neither, is talking about 1 and 3. She fasts neither the first round nor the third round, but she does fast the second round. So you see, these three apparently completely contradictory opinions can be aligned in such a way, admittedly, it's an awkward way to read them. But if you read them this way... What, Yehudi, 1 second, please. If you read them this way, you can align them so that they all are saying the same thing. That the only time a pregnant or nursing woman fasts is... The only time a pregnant or nursing woman fasts is... Here, the second round of three fasts, because this can be considered the first. This can be aligned with A, because she fasts the first of these two, but not the last. It can be aligned with B if we say she fasts the last but not the first, And it can also be aligned with C if we say we're talking about 1 and 3. She fasts neither of these, but she does fast for the second round. Okay, again, rather awkward, but it is possible to do it. Rav Ashi says that's the way to read it so that you can resolve all three positions. Yes, Yehudi.
The problem is Ha'ikar Chaser Min HaSefer. He doesn't have the word Emti Yuta in any of the brachos. So to proceed to say that that's what all three are talking about, when the word doesn't even exist in any of the three, is, to me, a little bit, like you yourself said, it's very, very shaky.
A guy walks into a restaurant. The waiter says, we have beer, wine, and whiskey. Which would you like? And the man says, I'll take either of them. So you could puzzle it out. What does it mean, either? Either indicates two. But he was offered three. So you could say, well, obviously, he's interested. You know, look at the guy. He's got a real beer belly. Obviously, he's not at all interested. He's not a connoisseur. He's not at all interested in wine. Right? So he must be interested in beer or scotch. Another person can say, no, you see, and therefore he wasn't even go-race the possibility of beer. The second person says, look at him, he's a very refined person, he's wearing a tweed jacket. Obviously, beer is not on his menu. So when he says either, he's not even thinking about beer. He means either the fine wine or the expensive scotch. In other words, the problem is that to answer either to a question with three possibilities is inherently imprecise or wrong. The problem here is that you have three brachiot that are talking about these series of fasts, talking in a binary, this, not that, that, not this, or neither, but in fact there are three possibilities. So you have to figure out a way to say, well, obviously these brachiot are ignoring one possibility to begin with and deciding between the other two. Is beer not even on their wish list, or is it the whiskey?
Okay, but still, the solution requires you to insert a word, but it's not in any of them.
Yeah, and that's why these Tanaitic texts were not canonized. Neither in the Mishnah nor in the Tosefta. They were left as mere outside brachiot. What's the brachta? The brachta is what's left on the cutting room floor. And it gets left there because it's problematic, because it's imprecise, because it raises these questions. When we in the director's cut of the Talmudic movie, when we take the stuff off the cutting room floor, right? We understand why it's problematic. But nevertheless, the Gemara is still interested in trying to resolve this apparent machloket. Now, all of this, everything I said until now. Oh, wait, now how do I go back to...
One second, why do we have to resolve this problem between the brachiot if they're on the cutting room floor anyway? They're just not precise.
Because nevertheless, the brachiot, which were statements of the Tanaim, are still not to the same degree as the Mishnah, but nevertheless they are still revered and venerated by the Amoraim that want to say that even the material left on the cutting room floor is worthy of our attention. It is still teachings of the Holy Tanaim.
We can come to a different result in any case. We can come to a different result just, you know,
oh, so what?
Flip it around the other way.
What would be your?
You can arrange it so that the woman has to fast the seven fasts at the end. You know, say the first. I don't know. You know, just
cool. Arrange it.
Why would you say that? How would that resolve with the first brayta that says she fasts the first but not the last?
Yeah.
Or not? Or the one that says she fasts neither.
why can't I assume that the reason they're on the cutting room floor is because they contradict the Mishnah? Or
They don't contradict the Mishnah. They contradict each other. If they contradicted the Mishnah, we wouldn't really be having this conversation, because in the Talmudic poker, a Braita versus a Mishnah doesn't really stand much of a chance. The only way to do that is to show apples and oranges, to show that the Braita and the Mishnah are talking about two different cases altogether.
I still find this very questionable, because as a matter of fact, what you're seeing in a Braita makes sense perfectly. In other words, I could say Mitanopa, Mishnanopa, and Mitanopa, because it's too hard for them to do it at the end.
So, Beseder, okay? How do you resolve that with the other? You're choosing between one of three Braitiot.
On the basis of reason. On the basis of reason, the first makes sense, the other two don't.
Okay.
Why can't we do it that way? In other words, it seems to me that on the basis of reason, the way Rav Ashi does it doesn't make any sense. And even over all the farsim that try to basically make some sense out of it, it really does. If you're going to go ahead and say pregnant and nursing women, Dafka have to fast the middle, then you got to turn, upside down to find a rationale why that makes sense, okay? Whereas if you say they only have to fast the first, then it makes sense on the face of it. There's nothing more you have to do. You don't have to twist yourself into knots. It makes sense. I don't see why you can't use
reason. Well, so why does the middle make more sense than the first? Or than the seventh?
It doesn't. That's my point. It doesn't. So the outcome you come up with is not reasonable. And the reasonable outcome would go with the first of the three.
But why?
Because it gets harder and harder.
Why is the first three series of fasts harder than the second three series of fasts? Adarabba, the first three. If somebody tells me I get to choose which fasts I'm going to do, maybe I would opt to choose the last set of seven, because we rarely get to them. In other words, the first set, you only move on to the second set if rain hasn't fallen after the first, and you only move on to the third set if rain hasn't fallen after the second. So if I have to choose which of them I have to fast, I only have to fast a parallel universe, I only have to fast one of them, so I would choose maybe the final series because there's less chance I'm going to get there. Or maybe I'll choose the first one because I want to fast. I live in a world where fasting is a significant religious ritual and not just an inconvenience.
But aren't you now making an assumption? The assumption is that the fast will be answered. Well, if you want to make that assumption,
I think that is the assumption that Chazal are working under. That the fasts are efficacious. It doesn't always solve the problem, but it's efficacious. So Rashi, everything I explain now, the Gemara as I explained it now is according to this Rashi. Nakot emtzi. There's a typo here in the Rashi. Emtziuta biyadecha. Klomar tsarich. Hold on. Let me make this bigger. View. Zoom in. Klomar, taritz de b'shalosh emtsayot hayu mit'anin umit ratzet lekulhu. They would fast, the pregnant nursing women would only fast the middle, the series of three fasts in the middle, because that can answer them all. Meaning, each of the braitiot, again, admittedly, with a little bit of shoehorning, each of the braitiot can be read into a possibility where we're only talking about the three middle fasts that the women would fast. And then Rashi goes on to explain it the way that I did. It happens that this is the halacha. I mean, it's the halacha in the sense that that's what the Shulchan Aruch says. It's not really halacha la ma'aseh, because we do not any longer have these have these series of fasts, but in the theoretical world in which these fasts exist, this is the halacha as recorded in the Shulchan Aruch. The Rambam, however, says that these women, the pregnant and nursing women, dafka fast on the final set of fasts. Because he understands Rav Ashi to be saying the following. When Rav Ashi says, take the middle one in the hand, he doesn't mean take the middle series of fasts in hand. Rambam understands Rav Ashi to be saying, take the middle of the three brightiot in hand when you fast on the second fast. The second fast is the second of three.
Of the paragraph.
What?
Right. He could not have had the matarts in Kuho. He would have had then just the cult emsai from the other.
I don't know. In other words, maybe he... that's an interesting point. Right? That's an interesting point. What is the Rambam?
Listen, I think, really, a little scarcer study. No, the type of thing that they're doing now in the universities where
I don't know. I don't know. It's irrelevant to speculate about Girsot if we don't have it in front of us. But that's the position of the Rambam, that when it says take the middle position, it means take the middle breita, and the women would fast the second one. In terms of pregnant and nursing women fasting on the set calendar fasts, at least amongst Ashkenazim, it's a machlokus between the Aruch HaShulchan and the Mishnah Berurah, whether pregnant and nursing women... I'm not talking about Tisha B'Av and Yom Kippur, but on all of the minor fasts, whether pregnant and nursing women can and should fast. So according to the Mishnah Berurah on Shavuos B'Tammuz, Asar B'Tevet, etc., pregnant nursing women should begin to fast, and when they begin to feel weak or ill or exhausted or whatever it is, then they can break their fast. According to the Aruch HaShulchan, lechatchila, on the minor fasts, they do not need to even begin fasting. On Tisha B'Av, according to both opinions, pregnant and nursing women should endeavor to fast until they are unable to, or feel weak or tired or ill. And on Yom Kippur, according to all opinions, aside from obvious cases of life or death, and a woman who has given birth in the last 72 hours, on Yom Kippur, according to all opinions, pregnant and nursing women have to fast. Okay, let's go on in the Gemara now. The Mishnah had said, Elu yeterot al rishonot, that the seven final fasts are more stringent than the ones that come before them. So the Gemara asks, Ma elu yeterot al rishonot? In what way are they more stringent? Ela shebe'elu matri'in v'no'alin atachanuyot. They sound the alarm, matri'in, and they close the shops. Commerce is closed down on the final seven. So the Gemara wants to know, B'mai matri'in. With what are they sounding this alarm? Rav Yehuda Amar b'shofarot. Rav Yehuda barei de Rav Shmuel bar Shilat mishmei de Rav Amar be'aneinu. One opinion says they blow the shofar, and the other opinion says, no, the sounding of the alarm is not with an instrument. It's with prayer. It's with the recitation of Anenu on that final round of seven fasts. Kasalka datach, man de omar be'anenu lo amar b'shofrot, uman de amar b'shofrot lo amar b'anenu. And we want to speculate. We might think that these are mutually exclusive opinions. The person who says you blow the shofar on the fast days says you don't say Anenu on those days. And the one that says that you sound the spiritual prayer alarm with the recitation of Anenu thinks you are not at the same time. You are not at the same time blowing shofar. Ve'hatanya. But there's a brisa. The brisa says, "Ein pochatin misheva ta'aniyot al hatzibur, shebehen shmona asrei hatreot, v'siman ledavar yericho." On the seven fasts, which have 18 hatraot, these 18, alarms. The siman for this, the kind of precedent for it, is Yericho. Right? And Yericho, what did they do for 7 days? No? They blew the shofar. Right? The seven fasts on which you're doing some kind of hatra'ah, some kind of alarm, if the seven fasts are somehow symbolic of the 7 days of Yericho, well, what would you think this hatra'ah is? Doesn't it sound like it's shofar blowing on those 7 days? V'Yericho shofrotava. In Yericho they had shofar. V'tiyufta lamanda omar banenu. And it seems that that's a refutation of the opinion that on those seven fasts, you don't blow shofar, instead you say Anenu. Because if the whole thing is learned out from Yericho, the number seven and Yericho, 7 days of blowing shofar at Yericho, 7 days of blowing shofar during this series of fasts. Ella, b'shofrot, dechule alma lo plige, dekarele hatra. So the Gemara counters that and says, everybody, even the opinion that we say Anenu, everybody agrees, chule alma, everyone agrees, lo plige de kare lo hatra, that shofar is, that this word, this coded word, hatra'ah, alarm, is a code word for shofar. Vechi plige ba'anenu. And the machlokes is regarding Anenu. Mar sava kare lehatra'ah, umar sava lo kare hatra'ah. The question is Anenu, the recitation of that paragraph, is that also a form of hatra'ah? Or is it not at all? It's a separate requirement, but has nothing to do with this obligation to call out the alarm. So the question is, everybody says you blow shofar on these seven fast days. The question is, do you also say Anenu? Or do you not also say Anenu? Or alternatively, everybody says you blow shofar on these seven fast days. And the machloket is, when you recite Anenu, is that an additional form of hatra'ah? Or is it merely something else entirely? Yehudi, is your hand raised?
Yes.
Have to understand, I'm not looking at you. I'm looking at the Gemara. This is not a regular classroom where you're sitting in front of me. So if you want to say something, so you should either click on the button next to your name that raises your hand and I'll see, or you should just speak out. But you shouldn't just speak out if I'm still talking.
Okay. I just think we should point out that the word hatra'ah and the way it's being used is a new coinage that the Mishnah is introducing that is not used in Tanakh. In Tanakh, what they would say is Miriam, and the word that would be used for the noun would be Teruah. So, in other words, this is trying to coin a word that implies that what's happening is to ask for Rachamim. It's not the type of Teruah that you do when you're in trying.
I don't know. Where do you get the idea that this has anything to do with Rachamim?
Well, what are you doing a fast if you're not asking for mercy from Hashem?
I don't know. Maybe the hatra'ah is not to ask for Hashem, but to stir the people to do tshuva.
Wait a minute. Shomei akol to Ruach Amo Yisrael Barachamim is how we.
Okay, that's a bracha about the blowing of the shofar on Rosh Hashanah. Maybe the blowing of a shofar. Maybe the blowing of a shofar on a tanit is a completely different reason.
Wait. You're trying to say that on a tanit we're less interested in rachamim than we are on Rosh Hashanah?
No, not at all. I'm saying the purpose of blowing the shofar, if indeed it is a shofar, as we'll see momentarily, the purpose of the blowing of the hatra'ah on the fast day might have nothing to do with rachamim, but it might be a call to arms of the people to get everyone invested in the tshuva operation, which ultimately, of course, is desirous of Hashem's rachamim, but that might not be the purpose of the it's a chok. The Torah says when the tzara comes upon us, you should blow a truah, right? As a matter of fact, even on Rosh Hashanah, the Rambam is very clear. Af al pi shetkiat shofar gzeirat hakatuv, right? Nevertheless, we look for a symbolism, right? Rachamim, hitorarut, whatever it is. But the reason for blowing shofar on Rosh Hashanah is the reason for blowing shofar on Rosh Hashanah is a gzeirat hakatuv, and the reason for blowing hatra'ah on a fast day is also gzeirat hakatuv. So I don't know if it's about rachamim. We'll see. Hold on a second. Hold on a second.
Okay. From a linguistic point of view, it seems to be that probably the shorish of Laria did originally mean shofar, but and then later came also to mean, even in the Lashon of Tanakh. By Lashon of Chazal, they turned Laria and Latria. But in Lashon of Chazal, in Lashon of Tanakh, in Lashon of Mikra, you have Laria originally meaning shofar, but also meant to call out in, to call out with a voice. And you even have that in Yeshua with the, in Yericho. Mm-hmm. In Perek Vav, Pasuk He, of Yeshua, it says, Vayabim Shoch Kerene Yovel, Bishamchem et Kol Shofar, Yeriu Kol Am Truah Gdola, Vinaflacho Matair. When they say there,
you don't mean that wrong with. Okay.
That does not mean blowing a shofar. When they heard the shofar, they all made a big noise, and then the walls fell down. So, in other words, it might have been originally that it was an expanded definition of or usage of the word, but there is even the case where you're real. In other words, it could be people making, you know, so here they're screaming, and there they're saying Aneinu, but it doesn't actually, even in Tanakh itself, even in Yeshua, which you're using as a counterexample here, it doesn't have to only mean shofar. It can also mean a human voice.
But you agree that the word lahatria or hatra'a is a word that's not found in Tanakh. And it's a new point.
So what? Okay.
There's a lot of these words like that. Yeah.
Okay.
Latrim is the same thing. Litrom. They took a lot of these words that were two consonants, right. And they made it in the Shon Chazal into three. That was not unusual.
So the Gemara goes on. Lamandomar. The first wide line. You see, Lamanda Omar ba'aneinu kol shekein b'shofrot. So according to the opinion that this hatra'ah is performed through the recitation of aneinu, that opinion would certainly say that that aneinu constitutes hatra'ah and kol shekein, how much more so the blowing of the shofar. The Lamanda Omar b'shofrot aval ba'aneinu lo. And the opinion, everybody agrees, it seems that like if you have a nenu and you have shofar, which is a bigger alarm? I would say a shofar, right? So everybody agrees that if a nenu constitutes a form of hatra'ah, blowing the shofar is even more so. But not everybody agrees that if blowing the shofar is the prime hatra'ah, That does not include aneinu. Vahatanya v'shar kol mine puraniyot. And whenever there's any other kind of tragedy, any other kind of disaster, hamitragshot, kegon, chichuch, hagav, zvuv, tzira, yitushin, shiluach, nachashim, v'akravim, all of these things, whatever it is, chichuch seems to be some kind of of, I don't know, contagious skin disease. Like everybody suddenly develops, boils or something, scabs with pus and boils, and everybody's walking around looking, you know, like something out of one of those, you know, medieval Bruegel paintings, right? Some kind of contagious disease spreads around. Maybe today they would add corona, or you have a plague of locusts, or of flies, or of hornets, or mosquitoes, or snakes, or scorpions. If you have like a band of these wicked things that are plaguing your town, lo hayu matri'in ela tso'akin. Right? If they had some kind of plague like this, some kind of affliction, they wouldn't sound a hatra'ah. They would cry out. They would tso'ek. What's tso'ek? Right? What's tso'ek? It sounds like some kind of tefillah.
Cry out to Hashem.
Midit sa'aka bapeh hatra'ah b'shofarot. So in other words, you have like there's a plague of snakes comes to town. So the Chazal say you should be tso'ek and not matria. So tza'aka is something you do with your mouth, just like saying anenu is with your mouth. So the Gemara wants to learn from this. The Gemara wants to learn from this brisa that tza'aka, tefillah, anenu, is in a different category than hatra'a, which obviously is done with a shofar. So tanaihi, it's a machlokas tanoi. The whole thing is a machlokas tanoim. Ditznan. Al elu matriin b'Shabbat. When do you sound the alarm on Shabbat? Al ir shehikifuhu gayis. If the army, if the troops, the non-Jewish hostile troops come and surround the town. O nahar. If the river is overflowing and is going to flood out the whole town. Va'al svina hamitorefet bayam, or if you're on a ship and the ship is going down at sea, on all of those, the Mishnah says you should be matria. Rabbi Yossi Omer leEzra avalo litzaka. Why do you be matria? The ship is going down at sea, or the bandits are coming to attack the town, or the river is overflowing and is going to flood the whole place. Why are you matria? What's the purpose of the hatra'ah? No?
This stuff is not to make people...
What did we just go through here? I mean, not us in Efrat, thank God, but here in the country. Right? So you hear the azaka, you know you've got 15 seconds to get to the miklat. The azaka is not to call Hashem's rachamim down. It's to give warning to the people. The ship is going down at sea. You blow the shofar. Why? So maybe the people that are sleeping down below will wake up and come up and they won't go down with the ship. Or maybe there'll be a nearby ship that will hear the alarm and will come to the rescue. The river is overflowing, right? People have to be rescued. It's like Hurricane Katrina. The tza'aka is to call people to aid. It's cool to call people to help. So obviously, not the tza'aka, the hatra'ah. The hatra'ah is to call people to help. So obviously, tza'aka is tefillah, is anenu. But hatra'ah is something much louder. It's something that has to be done in order that, you know, people should hear far and wide and come to thee. It's the call to arms. Bimai. So Ilema b'shofarot, shofarot b'shabbat mi shari. So wait a second. You want to say when the marauding troops come to town on Shabbat, you could blow the shofar? When are we allowed to blow the shofar on Shabbat? Ela lav ba'anenu. V'kari la hatra'ah, shma mino. So the Gemara rejects the whole idea and says, no, wait a second. Maybe it is talking about davening. Maybe it is talking about davening that should be done in order to call Hashem's mercy and to direct people's attention to Shamayim, right? That the Tana who says that this alarm is made with tefillah, right? In other words, that is a position. As both positions can be supported. Okay, I think we're going to stop here, and we'll come back. The Gemara is interested in knowing, what are we going to blow? What is the blowing with? Is it with a shofar? Is it with a shofar? Or is it with chatzotzrot? All right, that's where we'll pick up. Wait a second. What's next week? Let me just look at my calendar. Yes, okay, next week is fine. Next week, that's where we'll pick up next week.
Very good. Yashikaya. Yishakachacha.
Okay.
Good evening.